Hello and welcome to the Home of Medicine podcast with me, Dr. Amy Burbridge. And today I'm joined by...
Hi, it's me again, Ben Lovell. I'm an acute medicine consultant working in the UK and I'm back.
Yay! So today we are going to do something a little bit different. And we're going to do a recap on a case that we talked about on season 2, episode 7. So if you haven't listened to that episode, I would go back and have a listen because we are going to be revealing the final diagnosis on today's podcast. So, Ben, I'm going to take you all the way back to the 6th of June, 2023, when we first talked about this particular case. Are you ready?
Yes, it was a different time. I'm very, very excited to revisit it. But please do give me a refresher.
Yes, I will do. So, I'm going to talk to you about a 61-year-old female who I had originally seen in the same-day emergency care department in March of 2023, and she presented with chest pain and hip pain. I reviewed her with some blood tests and her D-dimer was elevated at 0.79. I wasn't too concerned about it. Took a history, did an examination, and my final diagnosis at the time was gastroesophageal reflux disease, being exacerbated by a recent prescription of naproxen for the hip pain and an element of anxiety and stress. My plan at the time was to tell her to ease off the naproxen, we'd monitor the hip pain, and to basically a bit of self-care, a bit of self-compassion. She was very happy with the plan at the time. And as we talked about on that podcast, it seemed a reasonable plan. However, I was then on a ward round on the Easter weekend last year, and she was in a bed on my ward on the medical admissions unit. And she presented at that time with sudden onset of bilateral lower leg complete paralysis. Is it ringing any bells, Ben?
Yes, I remember the case. I remember we were talked a lot about whether she had a unifying diagnosis or whether she had two diagnoses, i.e. a nasty neurological problem that caused paralysis and GORD, which you're allowed to have those two diagnoses, or whether we were trying to fit them together. And we had a conversation about sometimes how we try and force diagnoses into one very satisfying single cause, when of course clinical medicine isn't often that satisfying and neat, and it's a bit more chaotic than that. And I also remember there was a bit of mystery around the resultant MRI scan.
Yes, there was absolutely a little bit of mystery. So I saw her on the post-op ward round and she looked really well, apart from the fact that she had complete paralysis. It was from around the thoracic region. And the plan at the time was to do an urgent MRI, which wasn't available where I was currently working in the District General. She was transferred to the local tertiary centre, where she had an immediate urgent MRI of the thoracic spine, which showed metastatic bony infiltration at the T4 level with some surrounding edema. There was also some metastases in the left posterior iliac bone, and the L2 vertebrae also showed some metastases as well. At the time, her CT head was normal. Blood tests showed an elevated CRP of 120, sodium of 126, and a raised alkaphos and ALT. So at this point, we didn't really know much more information, aside from the fact that she had urgent decompression under the neurosurgeons. Mm. And really, we sort of left it there.
We left it there. A patient with a disseminated cancer from an unknown primary, which had deposited in her pelvis, but also unfortunately in her spine, causing cord compression that required urgent neurosurgical decompression. The primary was a mystery. And yeah. Remind me at what level of the cord, it was the thoracic cord, I think you said.
It was T4. Hmm. Yeah, and that was where she had decompression. And actually, she did have some quite significant immediate relief from that decompression. Hmm. However, the story continues. So I followed her up many times, actually, after her initial presentation, because I'd seen her in March with a very frequent presentation that we see all the time, chest pain. And I'd sent her home with gastroesophageal reflux disease and a PPI. And she'd presented a couple of weeks later with this bilateral paralysis. And at the time, it was, in fact, revisiting this case has been quite difficult because it made me revisit, did I really screw up in March when I saw her in ESTEC? Could I have done anything differently when I saw her with that chest pain? Now, if you remember at the time we discussed, she did, because of her raised D-dimer, actually had a CTPA at some point, which was completely normal. So that was quite interesting because actually, if you've got this disseminated malignancy of a mysterious origin, you may expect something on that CTPA and there wasn't anything on there. So I guess we could sort of say that it wasn't coming from the lung, potentially. But I don't know. It's even today.
Why didn't they? I never thought about this when you told me, but hang on, a CTPA, they would have surely seen a big deposit on the thoracic spine.
Yes,
The spine's included in the imaging.
it wasn't there. So what was really interesting is on that CTPA, when we reviewed it, there was no abnormality in the vertebrae. And is that because this was a very rapidly aggressive malignancy, potentially? However, even talking about this now, I'm sort of beating myself up a little bit, going, why did I go wrong in ESTEC on that day? Would I have done anything differently?
I remember you saying this at the time. Have you come up with any reflections or any sort of insights? You've been reflecting for the best part of 9 months.
A long time. I think at the time, I did the best I could with the information I had. I spent a long time with the patient. I did a full examination. And actually, when we talk about the final diagnosis, I would never have got that anyway from that presenting complaint ever. So I guess that's why there's a real value in following patients up as well. So if we haven't picked up a diagnosis or we feel that we've missed something, but the end diagnosis is something that even in a million years, I would never have got that anyway. So that's an interesting thought process. So I'll tell you about her pathway then. So we left it where she'd had decompression, but we didn't know what the primary was. And following this, she was admitted under the neurosurgical team. And the reason she was admitted under the neurosurgical team is because she had the acute decompression and they did a biopsy. Now, the subsequent biopsy didn't really reveal anything specific, and they decided to get hematology involved and specialist hematological pathologists involved to actually have a look at the tissue. Now, of note here, she had a HIV test, which was negative. She had a Hep B and a Hep C test, which was negative. And they did a whole body PET scan. And the PET scan showed widespread metabolically active bony lesions, again, suggestive of a widespread disseminated malignancy. She went ahead and had a bone marrow biopsy and trephine. However, whilst awaiting these results, she presented again to hospital after she was discharged home, much better, still awaiting MDT input. She presented with right hand new onset weakness and tingling in the neck and with some neck pain. The MRI at the time showed widespread cord edema at C3 and at T5. So by now, there were two areas on the MRI with abnormalities. And actually, throughout this MRI, there was widespread disease, which had progressed massively, even in the couple of weeks after she'd been discharged and had the decompression. So there was something going on here that was really, really active and aggressive. And the diagnosis did eventually come via the hematologists and with the pathologists who, on reviewing the bone marrow biopsy and reviewing the tissue that had been gotten from the original decompression showed myeloid sarcoma. Now, this was something that I hadn't never seen before, and it's a very aggressive type of acute myeloid leukemia. Hence, when I saw her in March, actually, she may or may not have had it. But that may explain why there were no changes on the scans that were done then. And actually, which is why she deteriorated so rapidly over the course of a few weeks. And she sadly passed away early May of last year. So this was a very rapid, very aggressive disease.
Hearing you say all of that now, I think I would put my money on her original presentation to you with retrosternal chest pain was nothing to do with her ultimate diagnosis. You
Maybe.
saw a patient who presented you with a common condition we see, which is NSAID-induced esophagitis and gastritis, which you treated. You didn't know in the background she also was about to go through this horrendous journey with a very rare hematological malignancy. But that was utterly separate to the initial contact she made with the NHS, which was with you. If I was going to gamble, I'd say that's probably how this went down. I can't even retrospectively make sense of this. What did you call it? Myeloid sarcoma?
Myeloid sarcoma, also known as pure histiocystic sarcoma. Rare,
I can't
incredibly.
see how that triggered the initial presentation that you saw her with in ESTEC. I think this is two separate phenomena.
And I think, actually, now you've said that, you're probably right. Because if she had this when I saw her in March, she probably would have been more unwell. The blood tests may have been more abnormal. And they weren't there. I mean, I don't know, and we're never going to know, are we, for certain? But we talked about in the original podcast, hic et dictum, whereas patients can have as many diseases as they damn well pleases. So actually, yeah, maybe she did have gastroesophageal reflux disease, and sadly, in the background, an incredibly aggressive malignancy that we'd never have got the diagnosis in ESTEC.
It just doesn't make sense in any other way. I mean, I've got to confess, having heard of this disease about 4 minutes ago, I'm certainly not an expert in how it presents, but it doesn't fit, does it? It doesn't fit with the initial diagnosis of what she came to you. So I think these are two separate things going on in parallel, and I think this is just a very, very sad coincidence. I think so, and I don't know. You were said at the beginning. Did you miss something in ESTEC? Well, you're not going to put a bone biopsy in ESTEC, are you? It doesn't seem to me that there was any sort of mind line that you could follow between point A and point B. This is sounds like an extremely rapid and aggressive form of malignancy, which was going to progress. And even after she was admitted and had surgery, had biopsies, you name it, she still progressed. So look, if the tertiary center with the histology results and the MDP that they weren't able to pre prevent progression to treat her and delay her demise, then I think, the general medic in ESTEC, I think we need to give ourselves a bit of a break from that point of view as well. What do you think?
I think having actually now voiced it out loud, and when you the first time I'd actually thought about it was the potential that this could be two separate things. Actually, I think, yeah, you're probably right. Because, and we all know that AML is a very rapidly, very aggressive condition. So I guess she may not have even had it then, to be honest, had she? Or it might have been sort of like lurking in the background. And like we've said, we're never going to know, but it raises a really interesting point, actually, that sometimes people are just really unlucky.
Yes, and I meet people all the time. I just did a weekend on call this weekend, and I've treated patients, and I thought to myself, there for the grace of God go I. There are some people out there with some horrendous diagnoses that we treat and we look after, and we just do the best we can. I mean, when I have a colleague. Or a friend or anyone who is feeling guilty or giving themselves a hard time or saying, I should have done a better job. One thing I find useful is I say to them, what would you say to your trainee or to your junior member if they came to you with this problem? So if they're a registrar, I say, what would you do if the FY1 came to you and said this? If they're a consultant, say, what would you do if your registrar said this to you? And I find that people are really good at giving advice to other people. And they say, oh, well, I'd say to them this and I'd say to them that. And I'd say, okay, well, that's kind of what I want to say to you. I think from a dispassionate point of view that we work in risk and we work in trying to balance judgments and trying to do the right thing. And it's much, much easier to lead someone that you're supervising or you're mentoring through it than to lead ourselves. But we can still maybe get a bit of insight in how we can process things internally by thinking, how would I advise someone that I respect through a similar situation? Have you ever done that?
Yeah, absolutely. I find it much easier to give kind advice to other people rather than myself. I mean, like you've just sort of talked about when, when somebody does something that they're not necessarily happy with, have a sit, go for a coffee. I did exactly that today. And we talk about it. And I'm like, it's nothing you've done wrong. It is what it is. And, but when it's myself, I don't give offer myself that kindness,
Let me
which.
ask you another question. This is sort of an educational supervisor question. How do you approach it if someone comes to you and they say, I messed up and something bad happened, and they kind of did? So you're not saying to them, you did nothing wrong. You're trying to acknowledge that, okay, maybe that could have been done differently and it might have a different outcome. I'm not going to sit here and lie to you. I'm your mentor here. I'm coaching you. I'm teaching you how to be a senior a doctor. So, what's your approach in that kind of situation? They're rare.
They are. It has happened to me a couple of times actually, and it depends on the timing of the situation. So, is it immediately at that time? So, it's happened a couple of times when I've come in the morning and the night shift registrar who I've been supervising has come up to me and said, "Oh my God, I've messed up." And I'm like, "Do you want to talk about this now or do you want to leave it when you come back?" And most often they want to talk about it now. They can't go home without, they need to get it off their mind. So if somebody comes up to me and says, I've messed up, they want to talk about it there and then. And I will usually take them out of the situation. So I'll go away from the ward, I will leave a busy office and I'll go somewhere. Either do they want to go for a coffee? Do they want to go and sit in a quiet space? Do they want to go for a walk? Wherever they feel is best. If they can't make that decision for themselves, sometimes people can't because they're incredibly distressed. I'll often take them outside if it's okay, the weather, just to get some fresh air and to talk about it and to decompress. And then I just get them to tell me the story, tell me what happened and talk me through it and just prompt them with little words, a bit like we do with each other actually, and say, okay, so would you do anything differently? What do you think that you didn't do well there? How would you deal with it next time? Really conscious of the fact that I don't want to affect their confidence levels because the last thing that you want to do is to say, actually, yeah, you did mess up, you're useless, which also does happen sometimes.
Yeah, I think most people come to you with their own solution. They'll say to you, I messed up. I did A and I should have done B. But because I did A, the patient had an outcome that they wouldn't have had if I'd done B. I feel terrible. And we're not going to lie to them and say, no, you did fine. You did nothing wrong. I think people see through that. It's phony. And people want to process, they want to work through it. And usually they come to you with this solution, I should have done B. And I guess our role, and by the way, I'm not just talking to consultants, I'm talking, I think even more so, SHOs and registrars get this because they're more approachable and friendly. They have a more peer-to-peer relationship. And I do see this happening, an FY1 in tears with an SHO saying, I've messed up, I should have done the other thing. So this is for them as well. But my approach is to say, why do you think you did A then instead of B? And then if you're saying now that you would have done B with hindsight. And just hearing that out and then acknowledging it and saying, you're right. A lot of people end up doing A and B in the situation you describe. I can imagine that. Do you know what? I think I've done that before as well. And it's tough.
Yeah.
Maybe. And now next time you will do B. But I think the fact that you've got insight into this, immediately you've reflected and you brought it to me. I think that's amazing. And I think that shows maturity, professionalism. And what I want you to promise me now is that when you have your own colleagues who come to you with exactly the same thing, and you will, I promise you will, you'll be able to share this story with them and say, hey, let me tell you what happened to me this one time and how I worked through it. And you sort of pay it forward like that. And I think it's important because it means that we all share freely our own missteps we've done before. So everyone knows that everyone makes them. I
Yeah.
think a lot of what drives people self-flagellation is because everyone is brilliant and I'm an idiot. No one makes mistakes except for me. So we keep sharing and we keep saying, I'm so sorry this happened to you. I can see why you made that misstep. I can
Yeah.
see you're bad about it. Let me tell you about a misstep that I made and how I worked through it. And here I am today. And one day you'll be here talking to someone like you. And it all goes a big circle.
Yeah, I mean that's the podcast, isn't it, really? We talk. I'm always talking about when I've messed up. I don't mess up all the time. It makes me sound like I'm sort of sex all the time. But and I think you're absolutely right. We need to share when things don't go great and be open and honest. And also, what I like to do as well in that moment with the whoever it is Talk to me about what was going on at the time in the environment. So let's think about the human factor side of things. So it was 4 o'clock in the morning or whenever. It was busy. There was huge amounts of pressure on you from all levels of management and everywhere else. You hadn't eaten, you needed the toilet, whatever. And try and help them, but to put things into context and say, yes, you may have done this, but it wasn't just you that was driving your decision making. There was lots of external factors as to why you made that decision to do what you did on that particular time.
Yeah, and then saying, okay, so next time you're gonna do it this new way, and you've worked it out yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. And sometimes there's the best thing for me to do when I feel I'm going to make a mistake or I'm overwhelmed, or I'll just take a step away. And I just say, I'm going for a coffee or I'm just going outside or whatever. And sometimes that 5 minute break can make a massive difference. Even though you feel like I can't leave, it's too busy, to taking a step away and have a chat with somebody can be really helpful.
I think that. And that takes a bit of balls to do, actually. And
Oh, yeah.
feel bad for doctors working today, postgraduate doctors, because they're so unbelievably busy. And they say to me so often, look, I'm not taking a break because it'll just make everything worse. Let me just power through and put this whole shift behind me. And I feel sad because I think about, when I would have a coffee with my consultant after the ward round and we'd go for lunch together and things back in the early 2000s. And those days seem to have gone away. And
No.
now I'm just like, let me power through. I don't, I'd rather not stop. And I think it takes a bit of balls to say, ugh, I'm stopping. I'm stopping for 20 minutes and everyone's going to have to cope with that.
Yeah.
And I remember being, too, I think FY1s, I myself would be too timid to do it. And I think it's a leadership quality in more senior doctors, registrars, consultants to actually say, I want you to stop. I give you permission. I give you validation. You must stop. I want you to do this job, but I want you to do it in 20 minutes when you've come back from just a little sit down. And I don't know if we are participating in that as much as we should. In fact, I know that we're not, and I think we should have a bit more oversight into what our team members are going through on a day-to-day basis. It's very easy for us to sit down and go, oh, wow, you made a mistake because you were hungry and tired and you hadn't had a break. You should do that more in future. That's easy to say. What are we all doing on the ground floor? Ask the big decision makers to make sure that happens, or are we just all talk and no trousers? That's my challenge. I don't know if we have any consultant listeners to this podcast, but there you go. That's my gauntlet.
Yeah, that's a good one actually. I think because I used to do this all the time was like 10, half 10, we'd take the team for coffee and we'd have 20 minutes. It doesn't happen because I'm like, well, I've got 16 people or 70 or however many people. And it used to be a finite number of patients I'd need to see, but now it's infinite. And I feel that pressure, but actually, if we took a break for 10, 15 minutes, could you imagine how much more productive we'd be?
That's a cultural problem, and cultures are hard to change.
Very hard to change. So my challenge to you, Ben, is to whenever you're next at work, is to do a mid-ward round break.
Okay, and that's also my challenge for you. Let's
Yes.
challenge each other.
Yep. So that's the plan then for whenever we're next on a mid-ward round break for whoever you're on the ward round with. So for example, if you've got registrar, whoever's on with you that day, you have your 10, 15 minutes and you go and get coffee or whatever.
Basic stuff, your basic biological needs. You have to look after them, otherwise you can't do the more complex stuff.
Yeah, okay. There we all challenged each other. Great. On that note, so to recap, Ben, anything that you want to reflect on that case? I mean, we've talked about quite a few things, haven't we?
I think for the case itself, I think it's very interesting to finally hear the outcome. It's sort of as sad as the case is. I'm quite comfortable with the fact that I don't know that diagnosis and I never would have made that diagnosis. I think there was time in my life where that would have made me anxious. Oh gosh, I don't know enough. I'm not clever enough. And now I'm like, no, that is not within my remit. I think I know enough to do my job pretty well. I don't think there's anything you or I could have done from the get-go. And as our conversation, we've got to be honest with each other when we do think there are things we could improve. But in this particular case, I don't think it was humanly possible to make any kind of diagnosis or change the trajectory of this illness based on your initial encounter with heartburn in ESTEC. So the last thing I'll say is following up cases. I profoundly agree with you. Even when I was a very, very new doctor, I used to all be before electronic notes, I'd go around to the wards and read the paper notes because I want to know what happened. Did I get it right? Did people like my plan? What happened? Did it work? And I find that's a really way of consolidating learning and getting some bit of job satisfaction as well. So, yeah, I always like to follow stuff up.
Yeah, I've got my patient lists, and I've got one on my computer called Patients with COVID from way back in February, March 2020. And I will often review them still. And it's such good, you do reflect and you learn, don't you? And think, so I am a massive advocate for following up patients, definitely. Thank you so much, Ben. I will take on board what you said about actually maybe it wasn't the sarcoma that she presented with originally, and actually could have been gastroesophageal reflux disease. So thank you for that. And thank you to everybody out there who's listening. Please listen, share, rate, review the podcast, and we'll be back soon. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Home of Medicine podcast, a podcast brought to you by the EFIM Academy in association with the European Federation of Internal Medicine, a leading organisation in internal medicine. Thanks for listening.